Welcome everyone to the Dunked On Basketball Podcast, where, as we cautioned, the Game 1 success proved to be fool's gold for the Bulls as the Cavs came back with a vengeance in Game 2 with their season on the line. Daniel, what did you think of this game?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of different things going on, especially in those in the first two quarters, but among those many things, beyond LeBron taking a metric ton of shots, was I think the offensive rebounding was one of the bigger stories, and the Cavs really making their threes.
Yeah, it was a problem for the Bulls. The big story was LeBron was so much more aggressive, blah blah. He only was 13-29 from the field. Did get to the foul line 9 times, made 7, but 33 points on really about the same number of shooting possessions, not something that you can't deal with if you're the Bulls. He didn't facilitate a ton, only 5 assists. Mm-hmm. So that wasn't necessarily what destroyed the Bulls in this game. What killed them was 6 offensive rebounds from Tristan Thompson and 14 offensive rebounds for the Cavs to 26 defensive rebounds for the Bulls. And through the competitive portion of the game, it was much, much worse for the Bulls on the defensive glass. And then also the threes, the Cavs are absolutely on fire from three in the first half, although they cooled off, and most galling to a Tom Thibodeau defense, which concentrates on taking these away. The Cavs were 5 out of 7 on corner threes, and that's really what kills them, especially because, as we talked about the last time we discussed these two teams, the Cavs don't have a ton of great shooters from above the arc, but you have guys who can really get hot from the corners on that team.
And two things that stood out to me, one related to offensive rebounds, is that in the first three quarters, which is what I considered the competitive portion of this game, the Bulls had 8 offensive rebounds and the Cavs had 12, but in terms of second chance points, the Cavs had 21 and the Bulls had 9. So they were converting them at a very different rate.
Yeah, it was a rough go of it for the Bulls. I mean, and you don't want to take anything away from the Cavs. They definitely were hitting shots that they did not hit in the first game. James Jones in particular, 5 out of 9 on threes, and I think he hit his first 5. So he was on fire, made the Bulls pay a lot. It was interesting that we saw, though, David Blatt start with Mozgov and Thompson, and it was really the first 6 minutes of the game where you would think that playing those two guys would play into the Bulls' hands when they're starting their two centers with Gasol and Noah. But in fact, what ended up happening was that size of the Cavs really stymied the Bulls' offense in those first 6 minutes, and you had another guy who was able to help and clog the lane off of Joakim Noah. And then on the other end, the Cavs were able to still get penetration and hit some threes. The Bulls were helping probably more than they should have off the perimeter when you've got two bigs on the floor who aren't really great shooters. So yeah, it really was that first 6 minutes of the game. I think I forget what the exact score was after that, but the Cavs were up by at least 15, I think, after that time period, and it was never close after that.
Yeah, they definitely weren't. And I feel like we have to get to it in the earlier portion of it, but some of the lineup choices were, let's just call them interesting, from the Chicago side.
Well, I mean, interesting and boring. Boring in the sense that Coach Thibs did exactly what we predicted and what he's still been doing and staying with that two big lineup, and that was really a big problem that the Cavs, I think, adjusted a lot more to on those Bulls pick and rolls that killed them in the first game, to slough off even more on Noah rather than the shooters or rather than Gasol. And Gasol wasn't able really to get anything going in the pick and pop. He wasn't nearly the factor that he was in the first game. And meanwhile, he was getting killed on the defensive glass by Thompson and Mozgov.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. And one of those, you know, it's a small sample size theater thing, but one of the things that stuck out to me, now that the NBA player tracking, they put some of the stats out there, and again, small sample size. Cleveland had about the same number of contested and uncontested shots in this game. It was 43 and 40. They shot 53.5% on the contested shots and 35% on the uncontested. It was just one of those weird games, but, you know, that does happen sometimes.
You know, I really wish that they would break that down by just jump shots.
Yes.
Because, you know, contested or uncontested, I mean, shots at the rim are always invariably going to be contested. So that's going to skew that number a lot. I mean, I think certainly your uncontested field goals, there's a lot to be said that your game is really, the outcome of a game is based on what you shoot on uncontested looks. But also another thing, too, is that the contested versus uncontested is not necessarily exactly good shot, bad shot.
Right.
A lot of the things that are logged as uncontested might be a situation where it's not the guy you want shooting it, or, you know, there is still someone running at him, or he doesn't really have his feet set or something like that. So it is a little bit dangerous to take those numbers quite as gospel. They are interesting, but it's a little better to have a bit more granular breakdown than that. But that's still, I mean, if you're not hitting your uncontested shots, that's usually a pretty good correlation with not winning the game.
Yeah, exactly. And it's also worth noting that I believe where the line is for contested uncontested is 4 feet. And there's some, you know, some question about whether that is where the line should be drawn. But that's a different discussion for a different day with people far smarter than myself.
Yeah, you seem to believe there's this enormous universe of people who are smarter than you. That's, I don't know, man. Don't be so hard on yourself.
I'm trying to be modest, Mr. Duncan. I don't know why you're trying to make me not be modest, but whatever. But, yeah, I mean, and...
This is the danger of recording this late at night, by the way, is you get discussions like this.
There was an over-under on that was going around using the Dunked On hashtag about how long we would talk about Nikola Mirotic's minutes. My over-under was we would talk about it less than how many minutes he played in this game, which was 7 minutes and 11 seconds.
Start the timer, right?
The big issue for me with this isn't so much Mirotic, though I think he's a very good player and he should be playing more. It's that I don't know... I'm having a lot of trouble with what Joakim Noah, who I'm a huge fan of when he's right and when he's healthy, what he is bringing to the table.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, and Heinrich played... He actually wasn't too bad. He was 3 out of 3. He didn't play too many minutes. Actually, one of the few Bulls with a positive plus minus. He actually wasn't too bad, although his overall season has been so far worse than Tony Snell's that it's hard to see why you would play Heinrich unless you're playing him at the one a little bit. But I would love to just sit down and watch film with Tom Thibodeau and have him explain to me what Joakim Noah is doing that's helping the team right now. Because I would love to explain to him how every possession Noah's guy is just sloughing off him into the paint. And it's really, while Noah has had some injury problems, you can say, all right, maybe that's why his defense isn't as good, his finishing at the rim isn't as good. I don't know what the heck happened to his jump shot. I mean, he basically has totally abandoned that now. Had some open looks, wouldn't even take them. At the free throw line, I think he's now like 1 out of 14 in the playoffs at the line. And this is a guy who, despite his unorthodox shot, was a pretty good free thrower through most of his career, well over 70% last year. So I don't know. I mean, maybe the knee is just bothering him so much that, or they feel like he has so many other offensive threats that he doesn't want to shoot it, but it certainly, that's a major problem that he won't even shoot that shot, even though it takes him an hour to get it off, so it's not as much of a threat anyway. But it really is just a major problem, and I think now that the Cavs have adjusted in similar fashion to what the Bucks started doing, where they're just not guarding him anymore, and you start to find your rhythm in a series where you just know, all right, we're not guarding this guy anymore. It's going to be a struggle for the Bulls to score with him out there, especially when you're playing him with Gasol or Gibson. I mean, Mirotic is the one guy who can kind of give him a little bit more room to operate.
Yeah, and the challenge for Thibodeau in terms of justifying it in that sense is that they have good replacements. This isn't a situation, you know, where your backups aren't any good, and so you have to play a guy where it's kind of that I know situation. They have a great front court. They chose to spend money on Pau Gasol and Mirotic, and they built a very strong front court. And even if you want to give Noah the start, he should not be playing as many minutes as he's playing. And that it's just hard. And with Heinrich, I mean, in this game, he played better. And I counted as the first three quarters for me, and he only played 6 minutes in that. So it's not great, especially when Snell and Mirotić combined for three. But Noah, what you said in terms of how they're defending it, I think that's just going to continue as long as he's on the court. There's no reason for them to change it.
Mike Preda had an interesting point, and I think this ties in with a lot of the reporting. Woj had a story a couple days ago about Thibs and sort of the idea that he might be forced out. Ramona Shelburne had a really nice piece on the Bulls today, and kind of what a lot of people are viewing as the last stand, at least for Coach Thibs this year, that Thibs really, I think, is going down with his guys. You know, management has brought in these guys like McDermott. Mirotić is kind of, you know, more of a shooter, not as gritty of a guy, at least perhaps stereotypically, although I think his kind of grit type of game is underrated. Snell was another guy that Thibs reportedly never really liked much coming out of the draft. He wanted Tim Hardaway, which, you know, Snell is probably better than Tim Hardaway ultimately, but, you know, Heinrich is another one of these kind of gritty Thibs guys. So, with that being the case, I think he's, knowing that it's his last stand, he wants to do it his way. And, you know, his way worked in Game 6 against the Bucks. It worked in Game 1 against the Cavs, but now it did not today. And, you know, I think we'll see how Game 3 goes. If that doesn't start off well for the Bulls, he may be just be forced to change or be at risk of losing the series.
Yeah. What do you think about how Kyrie Irving played in this game?
Yeah, I mean, we're not giving enough credit to the Cavs, too, and Irving hasn't been getting enough credit either with the spotlight on James, but Irving really had a wonderful game. He's been very efficient throughout the playoffs. Only took 9 shots in this game, but was 10 of 12 from the line, finished with 21 points, a really good plus 23. In this game. So Irving, while not taking a ton of shots, has been very efficient. The Bulls, I think another kind of underrated story here is the Cavs were able to get away with playing a lot of guys who are almost replacement level guys. Kendrick Perkins played quite a few minutes. Mike Miller played quite a few minutes. James Jones, although he did hit his shots, he's still not a guy who should be a big minute player on a good team. Dellavedova played 35 minutes in this game and somehow managed to be minus 9. you know, he's another guy who's basically replacement level, should be a bit player, 10 minutes or under. With the injury to Shumpert with his groin, which is also going to be something to monitor. You know, those guys, the Bulls just shouldn't be letting those guys beat them or they should be forcing those guys to beat them a little bit more, because when you have Irving, for example, this is a good example. Irving was getting into the lane all day on the pick and roll, and Pau Gasol wasn't able to be effective defending the rim. Really, Noah was not either. In the first game, the Cavs missed a lot of those shots at the rim. This game, they did not, or the help just wasn't there. But Irving is getting into the lane every time. Rose could do a little bit better job at the point of attack. But how about you make him throw it to Tristan Thompson on a short roll and make him make a play? Yeah. Or Mozgov, or God forbid, Kendrick Perkins. You know, these are the guys who are setting these screens, and they're pretty much non-threats. And although it's not really Thibs' style to switch those pick and rolls necessarily or have a guy come way out of the lane, and especially if it's Gasol, that's probably not going to work, but they need to find a way to just not let the ball handler and the pick and roll killed them the way they did in this game.
Well, yeah, I mean, you could think about that. One of the goals of Chicago's defense in this series should be to make somebody other than Kyrie Irving shoot the ball. I mean, he's been spectacular in this series, and I think he was really good in the last series with that as well. Let's move on to the reports that a player in this game, Jimmy Butler, is going to win Most Improved Player. Not my favorite award, but I think he's a deserving one if you're going to give it.
I actually think this is the most obvious Most Improved Player that we've had that I can recall in quite some time. And I say that because it's not simply that he has had a more efficient, better performance. When you think of improvement, you can think really of guys actually doing drills to improve, adding specific skills. And Butler has added so many completely new skills as opposed to merely refining existing skills that I've just been so impressed with his game, where he's able to, you know, his footwork is now unbelievable. His jump shot is pretty money now when he's open. He's got a post game. Just to go from where he was on a totally offense-starved team and not able to help them at all last year to being really the best scorer and a very efficient scorer on a Bulls team that has a lot of offensive talent, you know, seeing someone improve just their individual skill level in terms of adding new skills to this level is not something I recall seeing over just a one-year period very often.
Yeah, and he deserved it over another guy. I think I agree with you that it's very rare to see that kind of improvement. I would say that Klay Thompson had a year that in other seasons would have been along those lines.
Yeah.
His handle
was
a lot better. But yeah. Butler grew his game by so much more, and I would say to a greater degree as well. So he improved at more things, and he got better by a larger degree. So he deserves it, and it was a great year for him. And as I've said, I don't particularly like the most improved player, because a lot of times it's more of a situation where a guy just gets more minutes, and they go, oh, look, his scoring doubled. It was just he went from his first to his second year, and I don't think you should give it for that. But like Dragic, the year that he did it, I was cool with that, and I think that Butler is an excellent pick if you're going to have it.
Anything else on this game? I mean, I had in the notes here that I wanted to talk about some of these reports of Tibbs' imminent demise. Why don't we save that until the Bulls season is over, whenever it is? I mean, I think we'll have plenty of time to discuss that, of whether he should stay on or whether it might be time for the Bulls to move on from him at that point. But, I mean, I think you can kind of tell the way I'm leaning just preliminarily is I used to be actually one of his staunchest defenders. I think that he was someone who added a ton of wins, especially to these last few teams. I mean, and his Coach of the Year campaign in 2011 was unbelievable. But now that the Bulls are at the point where they're not just playing that all-world defense anymore the way they used to, his other flaws are starting to become a lot more apparent and more difficult to live with. And I think this is a team that if they start playing other guys next year, when you have Rose, when you have Butler, Mirotić, I think Doug McDermott is someone who might still be able to help this team. Hopefully they can re-sign Dunleavy. And, if those guys get a little more playing time, this could be an absolute offensive juggernaut, and also maybe in a more free-flowing system than they have been under Coach Thibs. So it may be time for some new blood there. But we'll see what happens in the series. Maybe they win the series, they get to the finals, and then, it's going to look a lot better for Thibodeau than it does right now.
Yeah, I also think that a change to go to a more offensive direction and the corresponding moves in terms of rotations and everything like that could also make them a more dangerous playoff team. And when you think about where the East is going, and I think about a team like the Hawks, if that's going to be somebody who they go against, I feel like going to more of, if you want to say more of like what the Warriors are doing, there are a lot of other teams in that direction. Going more towards that way, maybe not all the way, would make them a better team in that, because they still have those defensive instincts and work ethics. And also, I think that another coach would prioritize having guys ready for the postseason more than grinding out everything in the regular season, which I think has hurt them as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't say that was quite so much the case this year, outside of Jimmy Butler and maybe Gasol a little bit. I don't think there was anyone who he played quite so much in the regular season. And that to me, the lack of playoff adjustments and the player usage has been much more my issue with Thibs than the whole minutes thing, which, although I certainly think it's a problem, I think has been kind of overblown to some extent.
That's fair.
And I also think that, like, anyone who blames him for the Rose ACL in 2012 is kind of ridiculous. So, all right,
yeah.
That's enough on the Bulls. I think my prediction, though, is that or was that the winner of this game two is going to win the series. Now with Smith coming back, I think the Bulls really needed to get both of those games to feel great about winning the series. Or now they need to get both of these games in Chicago. Because if they don't do that, we've talked about how being 2-2 when you're the road team isn't nearly as good as it seems like it is.
Yeah, I definitely agree. But let's move on to Clippers-Rockets. Some people could phrase this in terms of a tale of two halves, but to me, it was a lot of it was my theory is that Blake Griffin got tired. He was incredible in the first half. I mean, he was one of the best stretches of basketball I've seen him play. We saw a lot of what makes him a special talent in this league because he could do so much more offensively. I don't think they're better without Chris Paul out or anything crazy like that, but Blake has a lot of capability. We saw it last year, and he can do that. And this Rockets team in the first half wasn't really adjusting to a Chris Paul-less Clippers team.
Yeah, the second quarter was massive for the Clippers. They had 41 points on 25 possessions while shooting 16 out of 21. And they started that even with their bench unit. Lester Hudson got going. I thought he had some nice minutes, especially he could be effective in this series defensively, pressuring up on Houston's old point guard brigade of Prigioni and Terry. So he had some nice minutes, and Rivers obviously has started playing a little bit better. Also, we got to give him credit for that since we always kill him in this space. I think the fact that he's been able to make his standstill three-pointers has opened up his game a little bit. And also the fact that there have been some smaller lineups that are played in this series lets him finish at the rim a little bit better, which he's not great at when there's help. He's not really that great at finding people either, but when the space is open, he can get to the rim and he's not having nearly as much resistance there.
Yeah, and to me, Austin Rivers is more of an off-ball player than an on-ball player, and so you can have him nominally as the point guard, meaning he'll defend the opposing point guard, but if you have him with a guy like Jamal Crawford, or you have him with Redick or Blake Griffin did a lot of the kind of initiation in this team, I think he works a lot better in that space, and some of the three-pointers he made and some of the plays in transition weren't his creation in that sense, and I think that's a good role for him. And yeah, I give him credit that he's done well. I still am beyond dumbfounded that he's been used as a defensive replacement in these playoffs. I think his D is still shaky, though I think it was in this game that he had a nice steal. It might have been in the last game, I'm trying to remember. But yeah, I mean, the Clippers did that, and then in the second half, the Rockets did a better job defending Blake, but to me, that wasn't the major factor. It just, to me, when I watched him, he looked tired.
Yeah, I think that's true, and there's actually a really nice piece by Ken Berger that came out yesterday about Blake's conditioning. I highly recommend reading that piece, but it also indicated that he couldn't sweat at all when he had that elbow issue, that surgery for the infection. He really wasn't allowed to sweat at all for 2 weeks. So he had to start again essentially from square one. And I think we've seen him wear down at the end of a lot of these games. And also, he's just had such an enormous burden placed on him offensively. I mean, he was dribbling the ball a lot, operating as a de facto point guard. Those grab and goes when you really push it hard, those can be exhausting. And, you know, as one of the two Clippers big guys who is effective at all, he's got to play a ton of minutes. But I also liked finally what Houston did in the fourth quarter, where they really have not gotten effective play out of their power forwards, Jones and Josh Smith. So the response was to go with Ariza at the four, and that opened the floor up a lot for their shooting. They're able to get to the basket more than they have. And Ariza guarded Blake pretty well, denied him the ball. And really, you know, Blake's not going to be able to drive on someone like Ariza. So the option is for him to post up. Ariza was fronting him. Blake didn't quite have the energy by that point to get around the front or really to post up hard right under the basket, which is another adjustment you can make as a power guy when teams go small on you. So, and then once Blake was able to actually get the ball, the Houston did a nice job of double teaming and rotating. So that was a useful adjustment by McHale, and I think we'll probably see more of that as, you know, once again, the league is just going smaller and teams are starting to realize that that works more and more.
Yeah, and one of the things that I noticed later on in the game, something that we've talked about in the space before, I like to phrase it in terms of feedback loops, and one of the things that we saw with Houston was in that third and fourth quarter in particular, they were getting more stops, and so that was fueling their offense, and then by getting more scores, they were being able to be set more on defense, and also with the combination of Blake being tired and everything else, they were able to get more stops, and so I think that works well for them. I would be a little bit hesitant to apply this strategy a lot more early because I think that some of why it worked was because Blake was a little bit worn down. I mean, of course you try it, but I would be interested to see how that works out, let's say, in the second quarter as opposed to the fourth.
Well, another problem for the Clippers was Jamal Crawford reverted. He was only 6 out of 22, and he took 14 shots outside the paint among those, 3 out of 14 on those shots. So really a rough game for him. He's another guy who I think playing as many minutes as he's had to now and coming off that calf injury, having to handle the ball, deal with guys pressuring him more, he has a propensity to wear down a bit more as well. But the critical stretch was that start of the fourth quarter when they went with the small lineup. Another guy who deserves a lot of credit was Pablo Prigioni. Mm-hmm. He had some critical assists, nice cross-court passes to Ariza and Harden for threes, and also drew a charge, which was a terrible call, of course, but he still drew it and deserves credit. And then with the floor a little more open, both of the centers were taken out about midway through due to Hacka concerns, and then Harden was able to get to the basket a little bit more. And you really need to have someone to protect the basket when Harden is out there, especially because he is being guarded by Matt Barnes, who had 5 fouls, and he picked up his 4th and 5th very early on in the quarter. So Harden was able, with no rim protection and being guarded by a guy with 5 fouls, Harden was able to have his way in the 4th quarter.
Yeah, that was where I was going. I didn't get there, obviously, very well, but I was going with the idea of when they had to shift Blake to center is that Blake is many things, and a rim protector is not one of them. And there were a couple plays where he kind of did the, I like to call it the David Lee play, where he went over and helped, but it was so late that it didn't mean anything.
Yeah.
And some of that is instinct. I think a lot of that is instinct, but you have to deal with that. And it's been remarkable to me in these playoffs, and we've talked about it enough that I don't want to hammer on it a lot, but the way that the coach of the player who is getting intentionally fouled has handled that in these playoffs has been fascinating to me.
And by fascinating, do you mean wrong?
Yes. Yes, that is exactly what I mean. And, I mean, there were a couple times in this game. I mean, and there are some other implementations. She's like, Kevin McHale was fouling DeAndre Jordan when Blake Griffin was out of the game and Chris Paul didn't play in this game. When you're thinking about expected value possessions, that might be a time that you just say, let's let our defense roll with it. And, you know, obviously DeAndre is not the greatest fouler. But at the same time, if Doc is going to pull him, then that's probably more valuable than even just letting the defense go.
I'll tell you what, actually, having this podcast has now pushed me pretty firmly on the side of just outlaw the Hacka, like they have in Europe now. Because I'm just sick of talking about it every night now.
Yep.
It was kind of interesting when we talked about whether it's a good strategy or not. And, you know, but really it's been every night now. Like, I'm sick of talking about it. Let's not talk about it anymore, or at least like try and keep it to a minimum. But yeah, I mean, don't take out Dwight Howard if you're Kevin McHale because he missed 4 shots. I mean, went 1 out of 4 in a 4 shot sample. He's one of your best players. Of course they're going to do it. The reason they're going to do it is because you acquiesce much more than because he misses the free throws.
Yep, and we will. I will make it make a concerted effort that we don't talk about this as much in the future. is there anything else in this game, or do you want to get to a couple questions?
Yeah, I don't think I have much more on this game. You know, we should talk about the fact that Chris Paul didn't play. Obviously,
yes.
I think that was the wise move. Doc playing coy about whether he's going to be ready on Friday, but I think having gotten a split, especially, they were wise to leave him out and see what he's able to give after. I mean, it's still not that long of a time. Like, to see how hobbled he was on Saturday and then coming back after 5-6 days, that definitely, for how injured he was on Saturday, if it were the regular season, I think you would see him being out 2 weeks, you know, 2.5 weeks or something with that injury, maybe even longer. So I don't know that it's guaranteed he comes back in game three. And if he does, he may not be 100%, or he may be at a pretty bad risk of re-injury, unfortunately.
The last thing for me on this game is, do you feel like, obviously they won and they had to win, but do you feel like today gave you much more confidence that the Rockets have what it takes to win this series?
Well, it all depends if Paul comes back and what level he comes back at. I mean, if he's not himself, or he can't come back until game four or game five, I think they could, but aside from that, no, I mean, I wasn't incredibly impressed. I mean, they're still just, they don't really have that many good players.
Especially to handle the ball.
And defensively, they haven't been able to be nearly as good as they were in the regular season so far. And that's been the biggest disappointment for them, for me, in these playoffs, where this is the sixth best defense in the league during the regular year. They have Howard back, who's athletically at a higher level than he has been nearly all season, and they still have had a lot of trouble stopping people. So that's, and with the lack of production out of power forward, the lack of production from the wing, I mean, they've done okay with Terry and Prigioni, but those guys aren't really guys you think of as starting caliber playoff point guards. The defense is what's going to have to take them home if they're really going to compete, and we haven't seen that from them yet.
Yeah, definitely agreed. One question that I thought was interesting that we got asked actually before yesterday's show, but we didn't get to, and it relates to the series that we'll see next, is your thoughts. It's from Mr. Monchi Dog, MRMONCHIDOG, and it's thoughts on Kyle Korver regarding Bradley Beal, and do you think it affects Kyle's offense, and what do you think they do in game three?
You would have thought that they would go with Carroll on Beal and Korver on Pierce, at least to start when the Wizards are going with their starting lineup. That would have been what I would thought they would do. But I think Korver has done fine defensively on Beal, and he's been able to, he's a guy who competes hard defensively, but he also hasn't been shooting the ball that well. So maybe there's an argument that, and he's also playing more minutes than he did in the regular season. He played 40 minutes in this last game. So maybe there is an argument that he's getting worn down a little bit, and that's why he doesn't quite have the legs. He definitely shoots in a way that you need your legs a lot. He's not one of these guys who shoots a set shot from behind the three-point line. He's still, even at age 33, shoots a jump shot. So you got to have your legs if you're going to shoot that, and especially when you're going to rise up on balance, sprinting off screens the way he does. So, yeah, maybe there is an argument. You know, that's one of those things that's always so difficult to quantify, to say, oh, how tired is he from guarding this guy or that guy, and did he now jump an inch less on this jump shot, and that's why he missed? You know, I mean, you're never going to be able to say anything like that for sure. So I think really what you do is you have the best guy guard, you know, whoever you think is going to stop the other team the best. And Pierce has been making his standstill three so well. Carroll is a guy who is much better and quicker at closing out. He's not someone who Pierce can really kind of bully as much, although Korver is also a pretty stout guy. I think they've been doing okay, but maybe they might try switching it up. But with Beal going only 8 out of 22 in the last game, I think you can roll with that for the time being, maybe switch it up. But it hasn't been a huge issue to me as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, I think that that's a good way of phrasing it. I think that it doesn't help Korver that much to run him through all the stuff that they tried to do with Bradley Beal. But my guess is that that's not what's led to the shooting woes that he has had, whether we can call it that. But, yeah, I mean, you try it, you see if it works, and also with the way that the Wizards have been playing more four out, I think you can try a few little different things and, you know, see what works. And that's kind of what makes a seven-game series really fun. The other question I thought would be interesting to get to, and you're more of the basketball historian in of the two of us.
Let's save this one towards the end, actually. I wanted to get to that one, but it's a little bit off topic. Let's save that to the end.
Sure.
How about this one? Why does Josh Smith get more minutes than Terrence Jones? His lack of effort and poor shot selection hurts.
Well, his lack of effort and poor shot selection do hurt, but I would say up until tonight, and maybe even tonight too, I thought that Josh Smith played better than Terrence Jones. That doesn't mean that Josh was playing well.
I agree. We've said that before.
Yeah, I mean, the reason for that, and also he has, he gets Dwight Howard more involved offensively, and I think that's a very good thing for Houston.
Yeah, his passing ability is the main upgrade, and his defense too. I think like Terrence Jones just hasn't played well at all. At least Smith is doing some things well. I think you'd be hard pressed to point really to anything that Jones has done well in these playoffs so far.
Yeah, and Jones had in this game had a couple of weird shot choices too. I mean, it's not like Josh Smith where we focused on it for years and it's a well acknowledged fault of his game, but Terrence hasn't. I've been a big Terrence Jones guy for a while, but he just hasn't shown me that NBA skill. You know what he brings to the table that you sit there and you go, we have to have that on the floor.
Yeah, at least not in the playoffs. I think during the regular year, he's had his moments, both shooting the ball. He hasn't been effective at all shooting the ball in the playoffs. And he was able to provide more energy and shot blocking and offensive rebounding, I think, during the regular year than he has so far. But, yeah, I mean, Smith has played better, but neither of them has played that great. And that's why going to that small lineup, I think, was good just to get both those guys off the floor.
Yeah, absolutely. Would you consider giving Josh some minutes at the five just to change pace a little bit?
Yeah, they've done that at times. And they actually did go with Jones at the five when they had to take out, or had to, in quotation marks, take out Howard, do the fouling, and that worked okay. Especially against those Clippers bench units that aren't really going to hurt you inside, yeah, that'd be fine for a few minutes. All right, why don't we move on to the next one. If you are the Bulls coach, who's your starting five and your main three off the bench? And I think we can expand that to, you know, maybe just what some of the combinations might be. Why don't you go first on this one?
Sure. To me, the guaranteed starters right now are the three perimeter guys, Rose, Butler, Dunleavy. I think that you can do that. I would say Powell is one of them. And then for me, the fifth starter would be, it would depend a little bit based on matchup, but I think I'd probably go Taj, at least at the start. And then it would be Taj and Mirotić that would be the primary guys. And Noah still plays heavy minutes, so he's obviously one of the guys off the bench. Brooks is the backup point guard, and you play them a little bit together. And then the other spots in the rotation, well, we already talked about the four bigs. And then I would say Snell is the next guy. And then Heinrich is break glass in case of emergency. And then they have bigs for that as well, like Nazi Muhammad. And so that would be my kind of philosophy. And then I would avoid playing Noah and Gasol together as much as I could help it. And you run the other lineups as well as you can. And that's pretty much what I'd do.
I think the bigs, to me, it would depend on what the matchup is for the other team. If you have guys who are going to really post up or hurt you a lot underneath, then maybe you need to go with the centers a little more. I think Mirotić is actually the best two-way player of any of those guys. I would start him. And with he and Gasol, I don't think you provide enough defense. So I think it's either Noah or Gibson who would be starting alongside of Mirotić. I think you probably would go with Noah just because offensively, Mirotić is kind of the only guy that Noah can play with. And then I think Gasol is someone that I would want to use a lot as a focus of bench units to try and keep him fresh, get him the ball in the post, you know, play him maybe more like 24 minutes a game to where he can have more energy to fight on the defensive glass, fight for good post position, get to the foul line, you know, as opposed to where he's kind of struggling to get the ball because he's out of gas having played close to 40 minutes. But I think I would try to get Mirotić to me is someone who should play the most of that group, not the least. And then Heinrich, I think, would be pretty much out of the rotation unless there were a big point guard along the lines of Michael Carter-Williams on the other team who needed to be matched up with. Then maybe I might play him exclusively as a point guard over Brooks, and then Snell coming off the bench as well. I mean, I would like them to try McDermott, but he's been out of the rotation for all year, and you really can't bring him in now. It's too late for that. When he hasn't had a rhythm with any of these guys all year. So you can't really play him, unfortunately, although I think his shooting could add a lot. So yeah, I think that would be it, but I wouldn't play Noah and Gasol together a single minute. And I think Gasol is someone who I might try and use as much as possible off bench units. And then if Gasol really has it going, maybe you can close with he and Gibson, or if Mirotić has it going and the other team doesn't have an amazing center, then you could go with Gibson and Mirotić, and that would enable you to do a ton of switching as well defensively and keep the floor open. So, yeah, I think that would be how I would do it.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. Do you want to do the last question, or do you want to do something more before that?
Yeah, no, let's go on to this one. It's a little bit more of a historical question. Has there been a year you can remember where injuries have had a greater effect on the playoffs? You want to go first on this one?
Sure. I mean, the big question with it is, to me, is I draw that in terms of when championships are swung. And so my first thought was when Garnett had that stretch. I think, was that 2011?
No, 2009. The Celtics were going really well, and I think it was in Utah that he injured his knee and basically didn't come back. Now that was a year where the Cavs were also doing really well. The Cavs won 66 games that year. The Lakers won 65. Orlando was a great team that year also, ended up making it to the finals. So I don't know that it was for sure that he would have won it or that the Celtics would have won it if he had still been around.
That's true.
But yeah, he was never really quite the same after that injury as an offensive player. So yeah, that's certainly one, although I can't really remember any other injuries from that year. Maybe Jameer Nelson would be the other one, actually. He was playing incredibly well, made the All-Star team for the Magic, and then hurt his shoulder and barely came back in the finals and was ineffective.
Yep.
So maybe that Magic team would have been able to win the championship if he had been operating at the same level throughout the entire year. Was there any other ones from that year? None strike me in particular.
I can't remember any from the West. I mean, odds are there was
some. Andrew Bynum, actually, and this is, it's funny, too. He never gets credit for this. He's kind of viewed as, like, a little bit of a joker, and he shot that three, and then in Philly, he injured himself again bowling, and he's viewed as kind of a lazy malcontent. And maybe that's true to some extent with some of the stories you hear, but you also have to remember that he basically played on a torn meniscus all through that championship run and went up against Dwight Howard when he was really, really struggling physically and then had to have surgery after that year. And who knows how much that may have hurt his long-term future, but he really gutted it out that year and doesn't ever really get credit for that in what was a championship season for the Lakers.
Yeah, that's a huge point. What other seasons stood out to you?
Well, 2012, obviously, is another huge one. That year, and it's interesting because the Rose injury, obviously, was huge. I think that Bulls team was the favorite. They had home court advantage throughout the playoffs. They were actually fourth, I think, in offense that year in what was, and part of that was because it was a down year for offense after the lockout, and they relied a lot on offensive rebounding, but that was their best team of that era with Rose being healthy. And then everyone forgets too that Noah later just had a horrible sprained ankle in game three of that series against the Sixers. So the Bulls might have even made it to the conference finals without Rose had Noah been able to remain healthy. And then for the Heat, ironically enough, the Bosch injury is what finally forced them into playing small. They really continued doing pretty much the same thing they had been doing in 2011 that ended up not being effective, just playing these decrepit centers, whether it was this revolving door of Juwan Howard and Jamal McClure and Zydrunas Ilgauskas and Haslam, and really the Bosch injury caused them to go small, and then they started playing Bosch at center, and that's what enabled them to just destroy Oklahoma City when Scott Brooks wouldn't take Perkins off the floor. And so, ironically, that injury is what made Miami what they were. And then the next year, they ended up winning 66 games and having that 27-game winning streak. If Bosch doesn't get hurt, maybe they never discover that way of playing. So 2012 would be another one that I definitely would point to as being a pretty huge one, at least in recent years. Are there any more that come to mind? I'll try and think of some while you talk.
I'm trying to think about digging further in the past. I'm sure there are some just off, but I can't. I'm not having trouble thinking of it more off the
top. Well, I got one. 2005, Joe Johnson breaks his face against the Mavericks.
Oh yeah,
that really was an amazing Suns team. Johnson, I think, didn't come back until Game 3 of that series against the Spurs when they already had lost the first two at home. And he wasn't really any good in that series, and that was not a deep Phoenix team at all. And then Dwayne Wade injuring his abdominal muscle when the Heat were the number one seed against the Pistons. The Pistons ended up making it to the finals when Wade really basically was totally limited in the last couple games of that series. So, which I think they lost in seven. The Heat lost in seven to the Pistons that year. So that's another one that comes to mind. Karl Malone getting injured in the 2004 finals. Chris Webber getting injured in 2003 is another one that really comes to mind in that series against the Mavericks. The Kings maybe would have won it in 2003 had it not been for that. They had basically their whole same team back again from that 0-2 team. And then, Webber eventually had to have microfracture surgery and was never the same after that. So really, I mean, just about every year there'll be something, where at least one major contender will be taken out of it. But I guess 2012 sticks out the largest for me of just how traumatizing that injury was. It was the reigning MVP. It was the number one seed that had the number one seed and then went from that to being bounced out in the first round by an eighth seed. So that would probably be my ultimate answer.
Yeah, are we going to count what Robert Horry did to Steve Nash in 2007? Does that count as an injury?
No, I can't say that it does in my mind.
Okay, that's fair.
All right. Well, why don't we call it quits for today? Thanks a lot for those good questions. That's gives us something to talk about on what was a little bit slower of a night for games. You can follow us on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan NBA. Danny is Danny LaRue. And also, you can give us a rating on iTunes. That always helps us out for sure. Or subscribe on iTunes or through the XML feed at RealGM. We're going to take tomorrow off since there are no games. So no podcasts Thursday night, but then I think we'll do a special Friday night edition since there are two games that night. So we will talk to you guys then.